And once more under the breach, dear friend.
Let's close the wall up with our English dead.
Which sounds a little strange to the sound of Amazing Grace in the background.
Right.
Well, you are listening to The Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake McClure.
And as we enter the second hour, I'd love to tell you to make a telephone call. You might want to test the phones and see if they actually work.
Do we have a hammer?
Oh, okay. No, we got a cell phone. Anyway, you know, normally we would tell you that the telephone number to call in here is 773-1400 or 800-914-7526, but we've had reports that they don't work. We're going to give them a little try here and see what happens. But we're still here, and this show is being broadcast on Saturday, January 23rd. And I guess it doesn't make a difference if it's replayed, when it's replayed. Because if you're not making, you can't make calls in. But we've obviously just been through a stock market that recovered a little bit this week. And it's up, you know, roughly 1.4%. Apparently the phones do not work in here. So apparently the stock market's up about 1.4% for the week. It is still down for 52 weeks, about 9%, the broad stock market. The bond market, amazingly enough, is also down. Not much, but it's generally speaking down. And of course, there's no formal bond market. So it all depends on what part of the bond market you were in and what bonds you had and what else is going on. But the bottom line to it is, if you've been in a position where you've been investing and you're following an investment portfolio, you're now looking at a very distinctly negative year. And that's a little hard to take sometimes. But, you know, there's a lot of underlying issues here. One of two things is true. Either the stock market is forecasting a recession, and it will be validated as it goes down, and it'll be validated, meaning by validated, that the economy turns down and the stock market effectively predicted it, or it won't. Now, so the question is there other, are there other indicators out there? Well, the leading economic indicators came out this week, and the headline from the conference board, where they comply the leading economic indicators, was pretty simple. The leading economic indicators in the United States are forecasting moderate growth for the next year. That's simple. Moderate growth, low inflation for the next year.
And by leading indicators, those are things that are already happening in the economy that we know lead to growth.
And this is...
Or...
One of the things
shrink.
Now, the leading economic indicators can turn down without there being a recession.
Right.
But so far, since about the early 1980s, when the leading economic indicators were put together and the conference board started tracking them, we've never had a recession where the leading economic indicators didn't predict one. So that's step number one. Second thing is you might want to look at is an interesting thing happened in December that, again, didn't make much headlines because it's not really bad news. We had the highest jump in existing home sales that we have seen since that number has been tracked. The new houses starts and so on go up and down each month, but year over year, we've seen that steadily rising. In other words, we have a steady increase in new housing starts, people building houses. Now, there's a big difference. Now, the last time, by the way, we had housing sales as high as we had them in December was in 2006.
Only in 2006, people were buying houses not to live in, not to possibly have family live in. They're buying three or four houses to sell them to someone else who wanted to buy three or four houses.
So this is another indication that we've come to the point in our economic lives in the United States where we are recovering very thoroughly from the events that happened in 2008 and 2009. Now, this downturn could easily turn into technically a bear market and go down to 20%. I don't know because there's a lot of events that could happen in the next few weeks. What I can say is that the market downturn in September, in August and September, that looked a lot like this one, except it just didn't occur on January, which is pretty obvious that it occurred in September. That one was blamed almost solely on the Chinese markets.
Right. They started blaming this one, this downturn, on Chinese markets too, but it fell off.
Here's the interesting thing to me, and this is where I think we probably ought to ignore what they're blaming it on. The Chinese markets did not rise Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday.
No.
But our markets did, which means there is no direct linkage, apparently, between the Standard Poor's 500 stock index and the Chinese Shanghai index. Number two, oil did rise. So this one is blamed, although it is the downturn, both in its severity and in the rapidity at which it happened, is a near twin to the one that occurred in August and September. In this case, the blame has been put purely on oil.
I'll tell you where the blame lies. The blame lies in a lot of people being afraid. It doesn't matter what they're afraid of, and you can come up and say that they're afraid of Chinese stock market, or they're afraid of oil price dropping. They're afraid. It doesn't matter, because the reality of the Chinese stock market, or the oil market for that matter, doesn't have a whole lot of bearing on the overall price of the companies in the stock market. I mean, if you think about a company like, I don't know, Apple and oil prices don't generally have anything to do with each other. It's kind of like saying the winner of the World Series this year is going to somehow influence how the Super Bowl goes. They're both kind of sort of related in that they're sports, and Apple is a financial thing, and so is the price of oil. But they don't have anything else in common. I mean, the oil price has some degree of bearing on the price of a smartphone, because they have to say, all right, we're going to ship it from China back to the States. But it's such a tiny percentage of the whole. It's so tiny that it shouldn't have any bearing on the price of Apple. And yet that's what people are saying is going on. The price of Apple, again, I'm not recommending that anybody go out and buy an individual stock, but the price of Apple is being blamed on the price of oil. It's kind of like going to the grocery store and saying, this can of beans is so expensive because my neighbor bought a BMW. What? No, that doesn't. But yet with the stock market, people tend to believe whatever's on the news. The news says the oil prices are dropping. It's causing a panic in the stock market. No, a panic is causing the panic in the stock market. Okay.
All right. Now, so we were going to talk about, it's hard not to get the telephone numbers.
Yeah.
We're talking about how to figure what is a reasonable rate of withdrawal from your portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
Over a long period of time, going back into the 1800s, the median earnings yield of the Standard & Poor's, Standard & Poor's 500 stock index has been about 6.84%. Right now, largely because the oil company's earnings are down, the earnings yield on the S&P 500 is 4.98. We'll just call it 5%. Now, that's based on third quarter and some fourth quarter earnings reports so far. So round figures, right now we can say that the Standard Poor's 500 stock index has got about a 2.5% dividend yield and about a 2.5% additional earnings yield, which means that the companies are making a profit in the stock market of the United States at about 5% a year. Now, if you had a portfolio that was composed of the S&P 500, that means that, purely hypothetically, you could do a 5% withdrawal. Now, that's not real. The reason it's not real is the market goes up and down, and there's a statistical aberration that occurs there if you take out a fixed amount of money, so you really can only pull about 4% because of the way the market bobs up and down. Now, if you were to take money out each month, and you would look at the value of your portfolio at the last day of the month and say, okay, I'm going to do a liquidation tomorrow, then dividing that 5% by 12 gives you how much money you could take out each month and be comfortable. Now, you'd have to change your income every month to do that. Most people don't want to do that. There's no easy way to do that. It's a real pain. But here's the backside to that. Almost nobody that I know of in retirement has a 100% stock portfolio.
It's true.
So what that means is that if you have the typical 60% bond portfolio and the 40% bond, 60% stock portfolio, you really have to back off and look at what your earnings yield is on the two of them. Bonds, right now, depending on what kind of bond portfolio you have, and again, that's a tremendous variable, bonds yield about 2 to 2.5%, depending on where you're, how long the duration is. There's a lot of complexity in that. If stocks are yielding about 5%, so that means, you know, what you have is a 5 times 3, that's 1 point, that's our 5 times 6, I'm sorry, which gives you 3% that you can take out from the stock side. And then 8%, 0.8% on the bond side. So if you had a perfect 60-40 broad, let's say you went to one of the index, very, very, very low-cost index funds, large ones, that track the bond market and another one that tracks the stock market, and you found the lowest cost ones you have, which are probably a lot cheaper than trying to do it yourself, by the way, with individual stocks and bonds, then what you would be able to take out is 3.8% per year, but you'd have to vary your income up and down through the year. Now, that's a shocker to a lot of people. It's a reasonable shocker because a lot of us old guys like me formed our paradigm about how the stock market works in the 1990s. Now, some of the younger people didn't. One of them sitting over here. He has lower expectations for the future, I think, than I would.
I don't know about that.
Well, you don't think you're going to get Social Security.
It's true. I don't think I'm going to get Social
That's
Security.
That's what I'm saying. You have a lower expectation of the long-term future.
I actually think long-term, let me give some qualification to that. I think that if my income drops and if I don't have any investments by the time I reach full retirement age, I'll probably get Social Security.
Okay.
But I think that if I am at a point where I can retire on my own, Social Security is not going to give me any money.
Yeah. Well, that is a rational truth. Unfortunately, a lot of people I've talked to who are your age or younger mm-hmm. just don't think they're ever going to get any Social Security. I don't think that's true either. But here's my point. If an unmanaged indexed set of stock market stock and bond investments that's done exactly according to the popular pundits' predictions, prognostications. Anyway, the PPP. We'll just call it the PPP ratio. The best you could hope to do is 3.8, but because of the market bouncing up and down, you probably ought to hold it to 3%. Whoa, you might say to yourself, that's ridiculously low. How could that be? And the answer is fairly simple. What would you get at a CD at the bank? The other thing is you can't take money from a CD at the bank. What you have to do is have CDs and savings.
Right.
So what do you get on your savings account at the bank?
It depends on how much money you have in there. Say you've got $100,000 in there.
No, not a CD, just a regular savings account.
That's what I'm talking about. Okay. Regular savings account, if you have $1,000 in there, you're not getting anything. Maybe 0.01 or 0.1, okay. Some small amount.
So let's say $100,000.
You have $100,000 in there, you're probably getting 0.6%. And if you
0.6?
Have for,
without
yeah.
a CD?
Yeah.
Okay, I haven't seen that.
I've
seen like 0.25.
And the reason why I say 0.6 is because I have an offer sitting on my table at home that says, open a savings account with us and we'll give you $600 if you put in $100,000. That's 0.6%. Now, the ongoing interest on it is not that high, but they're, in essence, going to pay me all the interest up front if I were to move $100,000 into that savings
account.
It says you have to leave it for 3 months.
Okay, so it's effectively a 3-month CD.
You can move money in and out of it. You just have to leave the balance around $100,000.
Okay. So the best I've seen, and I just looked, by the way, is 0.95%.
Right.
So
in a savings account?
Right.
Right.
And that's if you put a lot of money in there.
Right.
And so you get so
and you don't get that percentage if you take a chunk of that money out, right. You're not going to get that interest rate anymore.
So let's just say that you had the same 60-40 mix at the bank, and you're getting 1% on your savings. And what do CDs pay? Do you have any interest in
anything? It's going to be a little bit, but let's see, CD rate.
Okay.
Depends on the length of time. Okay, so let me pull up bankrate.com.
Okay. So we're going to look up and see what the best CD rates are.
Waiting on the internet for that. Okay, so let's look at CD rates. For a one-year CD.
I'm seeing 1.47, 1 point something like 1.5, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to get in a secure position, your average best case return is going to be 1% for the entire money that you put there. If you can go to the stock market and get 5%, that is a reasonable differential.
Yeah, you've got a 4%. That's called the risk premium.
But it's not just the 4%. You're getting 5 times the return in the stock market that you're getting than you're getting in a savings position. Now, why are these numbers so astonishingly low? And the reason they are so astonishingly low, and Lynn Woody doesn't like it when I say this. I understand he's on the air at this point, so he's not listening. He's on the air in Austin or something. Anyway.
I didn't know that. Huh.
The reason they're so astonishingly low is we are having deflation. And we've been here at the Personal Wealth Coach, Jake and I, have been warning about deflation as the future threat for several years. And Lynn, among others, have laughed at us and said the big threat, if you recall a few years ago, they said the big threat was inflation, that the Federal Reserve was pumping so much money into the system we were going to have runaway inflation.
The whole reason why people were buying gold, right. And yes. Yeah.
The fact is there is a big threat.
It's just the opposite of what the threat that other people thought it was.
And it is deflation. And we're having deflation right now. Now, we're right on the cusp. But one of the things that has come up economically, and I'm being nerdy here, if you forgive me.
I think that anyone listening to this program is primarily listening because we're nerds.
Okay. The price of gasoline has come down, and a lot of economists are scratching their collective heads, which is why economists tend to be bald, wondering where the money's going. And I think I've got a couple of answers to that. One, younger people tend to spend more money than older people, but younger people are now forced to save a lot of money before they can buy a house.
Right.
And a lot of people got burned after buying houses, and that wisdom has percolated through society. So people want to have a big enough down payment on the house that they're very comfortable they can afford the payments for a long period of time.
Right.
Which is fiscally responsible. But it also means that a lot of the money that's going into the economy isn't being spent, which means it isn't running prices up.
Now, 10 years ago, if young people had wages increased, they went home and they spent it. Not only spent it, but they also got their credit cards out and spent the next few months as well. They don't do that anymore.
So we're running scared, which is what everybody was concerned about, the savings rate in the United States not being high enough. Now they're saying it's too high.
Wait.
The savings rate in China. Both ways. The savings rate in China and Japan and in Europe is off the scale too, which is one of the reasons we're having deflation. The point is, when you save money at the bank, you're offering to loan money to somebody, the bank specifically. You're loaning your money to the bank. But there's a lot more people wanting to loan money than there are people who want to borrow money. That means interest rates are really, really low, A. B, little spending, relatively speaking, is going on. As a result, prices tend to fall, which means people tend to get laid off, which means that wages tend to fall. But
let me throw that in. There's a definition here. It's called monetary momentum. If you take money and you put it in the bank and you just leave it there, it's not moving. So it's not going from one hand to the next to the next. Mm-hmm. Every time it passes hands, there's a little bit of friction that causes more money to come with it. And that causes more spending to happen elsewhere. That's slowing down. That friction causes inflation. The lack of it causes deflation.
this is where we are right now. This, you remember I talked about a moment ago, if you can remember that far back, leading economic indicators.
Wait a minute, what were we talking about?
Yeah, right. The current economic indicators are what I'm talking about now. In the past, in the lagging economic indicators. But what are the leading indicators?
The current ones are called coincident.
Okay. So what
not
we have,
coincidentally.
Okay. What are the leading economic indicators telling us at the same time? Well, as I said, housing sales are up, but that's by itself an indicator, but it's not the indicator. What else is not making news? 292 in December in the United States, we created full-time jobs, 292,000.
That's a lot.
Which, if you spread that out over a year, we're talking about millions of jobs that are being created that weren't there before. And here's a couple of other indicators that are very, very, very important. The average wage in the United States last year rose 2.5%. Inflation last year, real consumer inflation, not the core inflation that the Fed likes to track, up 0.4%. So if we raise the wages across the board in the United States of America year over year by 2.5%, but the price of goods and services that people actually buy goes up 0.4%, there is more money out there to be spent. Now, it's being saved right now. It's not being spent. So
maybe they fixed the phone. We've got a phone call coming.
We appear to have a telephone call on 773-1400. So caller, you're on the air with the personal wealth coach. Go ahead.
Oh, and that scared him away.
Apparently
running
the phone
scared.
The system works now.
I was getting a phone not available when I called in.
Well, maybe
so
somebody fixed it.
I hope so.
Okay.
That'd be nice.
Well, if it is fixed, give it a try. 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
But here's where I want to go next. The government numbers on these things are subject to seasonal adjustments, and the seasons have been weird.
I seasonally adjust my food. I
right.
add salt. I add pepper. They
but
seasonally adjust by saying winter and spring.
There's something to be said for looking at the reality that you see on the ground. And here's something that is earth-shaking.
Earth-shaking reality on the ground.
You got it. That's
okay.
The best place for it.
All right.
All right. And literally on the ground. Walmart is the largest retailer in the world.
Yes.
It's even bigger than Amazon,
right.
which is saying a lot, okay? Now, Walmart announced this month that they are raising their minimum wage for non-trainees to $10 an hour. Now, is that a huge raise? No, but it's a raise. And across the board, whatever you're making at Walmart, they just gave everybody a 2% raise. Now, why is that significant? It's significant because that means wages are starting up. Walmart is the bellwether in this case.
Yeah, well, I think Walmart's actually the one that is the opposite of the bellwether. It's the one that follows the rest of the
mm-hmm.
herd. People have been calling for wages growth in Walmart for over a decade. And it's happening, which means that Walmart is confident enough that it can raise that level. At the same time, they're closing 256 stores.
But they're small stores.
And this hit the news, closing 256 stores. About a third of those are in Brazil. And Brazil is in a nosedive right now. Nobody's buying anything. So they said, we're getting out of Brazil. Okay, the rest of them are the little express corner stores, where they were seeing if they could make a profit in certain circumstances. Let me give a background on that just real quick. There are certain small towns in the United States that aren't serviced by a major chain grocery store. And Walmart looked at an experiment and said, if those small towns are on a major thoroughfare that we already have trucks moving back and forth on, if we're already trucking groceries from Austin to Dallas, and somewhere a mile off of the interstate is a little town without a grocery store, let's see what happens if we put in a tiny little grocery store and we just...
Is it a grocery store or a general store?
Most of the grocery stores. As the express is mostly groceries. So the trucks would go off the interstate, and they've been doing this experiment for about 2 years. And what they found is the reason why no major grocery stores have set up in those towns is that there's not enough business in those towns to support a grocery store. So they're closing the grocery stores. And it made it look like on the news that 256 Walmart stores are closing. And most people are familiar with Walmart as the supercenter, which is you could line up 18 football fields in there and still have room for another 18 hockey rinks in there. So they're not closing any of the big ones. Those are still profitable. They're closing the expresses because they were an experiment. It's a failed experiment.
Walmart was having some problems with their profitability.
Yeah.
And the biggest problem they had is they were unable to keep their shelves stocked because they couldn't hire enough people, which meant they have to raise wages to $10 an hour to attract enough employees to make a profit.
And higher quality employees, for that matter. I'm going to give you an anecdote. I was in Walmart. I don't go to Walmart very often, but I was in Walmart not that long ago, and I was looking for a coat for my daughter. My daughter is one and needs a coat. So I walked into an employee, and I was trying to find where the coats were. I couldn't find them, and I went to the employee, and I said, "Can you tell me where?" And she pointed, and I thought, this is either a psychic or she just wants to get rid of me, because she pointed off in a random direction, and I said, "Coats for a baby." And she said, "Oh," and she pointed in a different direction. And I said, "This is for a baby girl." And she pointed in a different direction. So this was I'm not trying to denigrate the typical Walmart employee, but.
Where did she point originally?
I vaguely off towards electronics. She didn't know what she was pointing for. She just wanted me to stop asking her questions. So eventually I bought the jacket and we left. But that was an example. When I got back in the car, I was talking to my wife as we're driving away going, that was not good customer service. And if you'll recall, one of the big things about the growth of Walmart, the thing that caused Walmart to explode across the country, was that you could go in there and talk to an employee and they were personable and they were friendly and they would tell you they might follow you to the place where you're going to help you try on the jackets. And
I missed that.
I remember it because I remember particularly in sporting goods. You could wander around sporting goods, and the people that worked in the Walmart sporting goods section loved sporting goods. They loved to show you the rifles and the shotguns, mm-hmm. and they would show you the camping gear, and they say they tried this camping gear and they tried that camp. And that was pretty typical of a Walmart 20 years ago. 10 years ago, not so much. And right now, really not so much. And they're trying to change that. They're turning around and they say they're going to raise the amount of money. And if you recall, when Walmart first took off, one of the reasons why they did so well and Kmart started falling down is because they were hiring people away from Kmart to come work at Walmart. And Kmart was the behemoth at that point. They were hiring the Kmart employees to come over and work at Walmart because they were paying them more. Now Walmart's competition isn't Kmart, it's Target. And Target has a much higher wage. And so Target's hiring people away from Walmart. And in a recession time period, Walmart did great. Target didn't do so well. Now we're not in a recession anymore. The profitability of Walmart has dropped and Target has gone up.
But the point I wanted to make here is that when the economy of the United States is somewhere between 60 and 70%, depending on whose numbers you look at, is generated by consumers. One of the reasons that retail sales appear to be down, which they aren't, is because the price of gasoline is down. So when people buy gasoline, there are fewer dollars. Now, if you look at unit sales, it's up. If you look at dollars, it's down. But when Walmart starts raising its wages, when we see that last year we had a 2.5% raise, and we're seeing that raise percolate all the way down to Walmart, that means in 2016 there will be more money to be spent and lower prices to spend it on. In the long term, every indicator that I look at tells me the United States economy is in good shape except one.
I can think of one right now.
Okay.
New housing starts.
No, that's in good shape.
I'm talking, well,
it's not as high as it was in the past.
Right.
But it's rising year over year,
right,
steadily.
Okay, so now it's better than it was, and it's steadily getting better than that.
And the prices of these new houses, by the way, are considerably higher than they were,
right,
in 2006, because we don't have as much cheap labor to do it with, because we don't have as many illegal immigrants, very frankly.
Correct.
But the one negative is exports.
And that's because we have a strong dollar.
We have a very strong dollar.
Somebody in Germany wants to buy something from the United States. The dollar has risen against the euro, so it's more expensive now than it was,
right,
2 years ago by a lot.
The good news is that imports are cheaper, particularly from China, which means that further deflation goes underway, which means it looks like consumer spending is down when they're buying the same amount of stuff. Very similar to oil imports.
Let me hit this one piece. Our biggest trading partner is Canada. And a year and a half ago, the Canadian dollar was trading at one U.S. dollar. And just a little bit before that, it was $1 to $2 to buy one Canadian dollar. And that's kind of unheard of, because all through my childhood and up through my adult life till very recently, the Canadian dollar was worth a lot less than the American dollar. Now the Canadian dollar is trading at 70 cents U.S. to one Canadian dollar.
So what's happened is you see some manufacturing numbers down. And the reason the manufacturing number, although interestingly enough, the flash PMI came out. Now what's a flash PMI? Sounds like something nasty. The flash PMI is when they get about 80 to 90% of the purchasing managers reporting in to the people who gathered market. The MARKIT is the name of the organization. They get them to report in, and we see something interesting. The purchasing managers index is at 52.7, which is a really nerdy number. Anything above 50 is expansion. And when manufacturing purchase manager index rises, that means that the manufacturing side of our economy has got more orders coming in than they did previously.
Right.
Anything above 50 is growth. It's accelerating. Now, why 52 is not a hugely high number. 55 really is impressive. But it is a hugely high number in the face of the fact that nobody is ordering new oil exploration or pipeline building,
right,
equipment.
And throw in one other piece. Nobody anywhere else in the world is having manufacturing,
right,
increase.
So all these little incidental numbers are leading indicators. They indicate that businesses across the country, from Walmart to Caterpillar, are seeing down the road more business orders coming in. They're seeing expansion. They're seeing a reason to raise wages and expand their business. Meanwhile, the folks who live on Wall Street, by the way, I guess you know the big news.
Do people live on Wall Street?
Yeah, they go home and sleep someplace else, but they live on Wall Street.
Oh, yeah, okay.
They, on the other hand, are seeing bad news everywhere they look, and I can tell you why. A guy looked out the window a little while back and said, snow is falling.
Uh-huh.
And they said, sell, 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 snow is falling.
I think it'd be interesting. This is just my own personal opinion, but I think they should name one of the SpaceX rockets the stock market.
And then it'd have it blow up.
Well, you can say the stock market is taking off today, blasted off like a rocket into outer space. Oh, it's coming back to Earth at a very high rate of speed. The trajectory is, and then you wouldn't need to have the stock market crash or boom or any of that. You could just say crash and boom. Stock creates its own sound effects.
Meanwhile, back at the ranch, I think we need to do some commercials.
Yes.
Because this is KTEM. By the way, the telephones appear to be working.
Sort of. Maybe.
Give us a shot. Try 773-1400 or 1-866-597-1400. Give us a call and say something or comment about what we've done or whatever. Of course, if no one's listening, that won't happen, in which case you will be listening to the commercials.
What do you mean, if no one's listening? I'm not even listening.
Yeah, okay, so we'll be back after these commercials. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake McClure.
And we have about 16 minutes left in this second hour on today, January 23rd. Again, the telephone number is in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400. And we have verified that those numbers work. So 773-1400 or 1-866-597-1400.
A little earlier, I was talking about the rate of withdrawal you take from your portfolio. And I said roughly 3.8%. That's if you had a perfect 60 or 40-60 mix or 60-40 mix in the portfolio of stocks and bonds. There are other asset classes that have a higher earnings yield and within the stock market. And those are the ones where you have the opportunity to run it up a little higher, but this is something where you need to get a professional involved. We do have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hello, hi, Rick.
Boy, it's good to hear a voice. All right. Well, I like to have a history with more of it, personally. But, yeah. Sure. Thank you.
Okay. Right.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, that's it.
Okay.
Excellent.
We'll talk to you later. The different ways of paying for things, and that's one of the things that's changing very quickly. Apple Pay, the issue of being able to tap your watch or cell phone on a device.
Eventually, not even having a cell phone or device, just walking by and having it know who you are.
That's I haven't seen that one yet.
It's coming. It's not something that's there yet, but the idea of bio scans and so on, that's it's very real possibility.
But right now, we are seeing an advent in some markets of the ability to tap your cell phone or your watch, if you have an Apple Watch, on a device and pay for something. By the way, one of the things that I finally encountered for the first time at Lowe's was the necessity to actually plug my credit card into the machine rather than swiping with it.
Right, because it has a chip on the front.
And that's a big plus when it comes to credit card fraud.
Or lack of credit card fraud. Yeah.
And the other thing, of course, is changing in our society, and a lot of people are very familiar with this, other people not at all, is increasing number of people don't have checking accounts. They just don't have checkbooks.
Well, they have checking accounts. They just use a debit card.
But that means they have an account. But
it's not called a checking account if you don't have a check anymore, except they call it a checking account.
And there's some big changes going on in the way money is processed. I can even see a cashless society within my lifetime.
Let me emphasize something here, though. It used to be when I went to school and people before me went to school, they would teach balancing the checkbook. And that's kind of, they still teach balancing the checkbook, but people don't even have checks. So if the young people are coming up, or even people in their 30s coming up, don't have a checkbook, never had a checkbook, or haven't had a checkbook in 15 years, and they have a debit card, and they're not balancing anymore. Because when you use a debit card, there's nothing to write on. And there are some apps that are coming out for that to help with it. But the reality is that people need to know and keep track of what they're spending so they don't bounce their debit or get refused when they go to use it. Rick was asking for some advice so that people could later on have money, enough money to come and see us. One big thing is, and this is weird because I know a lot of people want to hear us talk about investments, but the number one priority way before you start investing, even before paying off credit card debt, is making sure you have a good savings position. So the discipline of allocating some of your money every month to savings for emergencies and so on, that has to come before anything else. Even if you have a lot of credit card debt, and a lot of people say, I just want to throw as much money as I possibly can every month towards my credit cards. This is something that's really important. If you have very little money in your bank and you have, say, $6,000 in credit card debt, and every month you spend every available extra dollar to try to pay down your credit card, and then you have a series of flat tires, or you have a tree fall down and mess up your car or whatever, you're not going to have any money in the bank to pay for the emergency, so you have to get the credit cards out again to pay for it. If you allocate at the beginning money into your savings positions, and then once you feel comfortable about having emergencies taken care of, taking the remaining money as it comes in and pushing it towards paying off your credit card debts, you're a lot more likely to get out of debt than if you just take it all and throw it at the credit cards. And that's not intuitive. That's counterintuitive, because you think the best way to get out of credit card debt is to pay off your credit card debt. The reality is the best way to get out of credit card debt is to save some money and then pay money every month to get out of credit card debt. One of the things that I tell people very regularly, and this is vastly important, if you've got a lot of credit card debt, you've got no money in the bank, and suddenly you have $6,000. You got a bonus, you got a big tax return, somehow you've got some extra money. And you look up and you say, I'm just going to take it all and pay off my credit card debts. Well, then you have no savings left. And what I tell people is take a big chunk of that money, put it in savings. Don't touch it. That's emergency money. That's to keep you out of debt in the future. Then use what remains to start the paying off of your credit cards. I realize this is weird. Don't invest it all at once. You need to prioritize your money, and the number one priority always is savings.
And there's another thing you can do, and Rick mentioned that. We haven't talked about it much lately. Fund your 401k. Fund
if you've
your
got
403b, and when you do so in the least expensive version that you can. Some 403bs are so outrageously expensive internally that it's amazing they make any money at all. Fund something in equities in the market over the long term. It goes up and down. If you have the opportunity to invest more when it's down, it's a good idea. The people we see today whose portfolios we manage with seven figures didn't get there all at once. By and large, they got there because they regularly invested about 10, sometimes as much as 20% of their income year after year after year after year in down markets and up markets. They just kept investing in the United States economy. They became owners of those major industries across the country. They became owners of the stocks and to some degree the bonds, both in the United States and outside the United States. And as a result, they're able to retire, not having made any more money than somebody else who retires broke and is now working at Walmart or something. They made money from corporate profits for 20 or 30 years. And in doing so, they made themselves financially independent. And despite all of the negativity, there's absolutely no reason that I can imagine that wouldn't work over the next 20 years.
This is something that I've talked about on the air a couple of times before, but in the beginning of the 20th century, there was this new thing that popped up, and people still know about it today, the IQ test. They say these people are smarter. That's going to be the biggest indicator of whether or not they're successful later in life. Well, there was a 40-year experiment done at the beginning of the 20th century where they took kids in high school and they gave them IQ tests, and then they took the ones that scored the highest out of a whole string of different high schools, and they said, we're going to follow them for 40 years and watch what happens to them. And over the next 40 years, what they found is those people with high IQs did have a lot higher net worth and income and a lot of other things. Except that if you started looking into the details, you found that the bottom 50%, half of that group, was below average. And the top 50% was way above average, and that brought up all the people with the high IQs. And we've all known people with really high IQs that sit in a garage all day long, let their hair grow out, never shave, never shower. And you say, wow, they're very smart people, and they just have no motivation. So at the end of the 40 years, so some of the people in this experiment, by the way, are people that you know of. These are the producers and the writers of the I Love Lucy show were in this experiment. And some Nobel Prize winners were in this experiment. And so that IQ is a good indicator of something. It's okay, they've got smarts. At the end of that experiment, a guy named Bauer in Florida started working on something with marshmallows with kids, because they needed to find a better way of indicating success. So they have kids.
What was the result of the IQ? The high IQ test retired wealthy?
On average, except that about the bottom half of them retired poorer than the average other people with low IQ.
So people with unusually high IQs, but not the very highest.
Even the very highest and 140 above. So that's unusually high.
That is the question.
Okay.
The people who had very high IQs, but not the very peak, wound up at the end of their working lifetime with less net worth than the people, the average person.
No.
Okay.
If you take a group of people with high IQ and you mix them all together, so the high IQs, the top IQs are mixed in there with them. So the bottom 50% of the people as far as success goes in that group. So some of the highest IQs were in this bottom 50%. Retired or had their middle of life at a much lower income than the average citizen.
What you're saying then is the IQ rate did not predict
as a whole? Yes, because half of those people did a lot better, enough to bring up the average for all those people with the high IQ to way above the normal person.
Okay.
But a huge chunk of those people with high IQ were making a lot less than the normal average person walking down the street.
That's what I wanted.
Okay, so what we found is that it's not really a good indicator of success, because half of them do really well and half of them do really, really poorly. It's just an indicator of that they're either going to do really well or really poorly. They're not going to be average. All right, so then they started studying kids sitting in a room, empty room with a table in it and a chair, and there's a one-way mirror, and the kid's sitting at the table, and they're presented with a marshmallow. And the kids are 3 to 5 years old. And there's some recent examples of this experiment, because they're still running the experiment. So you can look it up on YouTube, do the marshmallow experiment. It's worth it. And they put the marshmallow in front of a 3-year-old or a 5-year-old, and they say, this marshmallow belongs to you, and you can eat it if you want. But if you wait till I come back and you haven't eaten it, you're going to get 2 marshmallows. So then they leave, and there's a camera running in the newer experiments. Otherwise, it was just people watching. And they were timing how long it took the kids to eat the marshmallows. And the vast majority of the kids eat the marshmallow right away. About 10% of the kids don't eat the marshmallow. They wait. They wait for the whole 15 minutes. Now think of a 3-year-old waiting 15 minutes with nothing in the room to look at but a marshmallow. That's a pretty extreme amount of willpower. They've now been running this experiment for 60 years, and it is the highest indicator of long-term success that we've been able to find. The ability to wait for gratification, to say, I'm going to get more if I wait. It's rare, but you can encourage it. It's like a muscle. The more you use it, the stronger it gets. And that's the biggest piece of success, because the only way that you figure out to invest money is to wait to eat the marshmallow, because it's money that you could spend today. Instead, you want to spend the money later when there's more of it.
If there was a good time, by the way, to invest.
Oh boy, is it now.
It's now. And I realize a lot of people are saying the market is still high and we're headed into a bear market. All I can say is the market is below its long-term averages in terms of almost everything. It's a good time to invest. it's also a good time to think seriously about the way you're taking money out of the market if you're withdrawing money. And that doesn't mean you stop. It just means that you need to pay attention and be aware. You're like that self-employed person. You don't have a boss. You don't have somebody who's regulating you. It's also worth
remembering. You are your boss.
It's also worth remembering that the principal thing that caused General Motors to go bankrupt was its pension fund. The fact that it had to pay so much in retirement benefits to its retirees that it couldn't stay in business. And there's an old saying, Chairman Smith, good name, of General Motors once said, what's good for the United States is good for General Motors, and what's good for General Motors is good for the United States. There's probably a lot of truth in that.
Yeah.
In that, if you want a steady retirement, if you want a consistent retirement, you need to be flexible with it. General Motors couldn't be flexible.
It broke them.
And it broke them. So it's worth paying attention to. It's worth talking to your professional about.
And we're out of time for this week.
And if you'd like to give us a call off the air, during the weekend, we have voicemail. During the week, we have live people, of course, answering the phone, 947-1111.
You can reach that same voicemail or live people toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. We've got a lot of good stuff on there. We've got emails that we send out regularly and newsletters talking about where the economy is and where it is again. And you can read about our philosophy. You can listen to our podcasts. You can see our ugly mugs and the beautiful staff that we work with. If you would like to email us directly, you can email Jeff at tpwc.com or Jake at tpwc.com. Until next week.
Serving Central Texas, KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort.